Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. As the days pass, the U.S.-Israel military campaign against Iran is resembling more like epic mistake instead of epic fury. Indeed, the regional and geopolitical implications are becoming apparent. The United States and Israel are not winning, as Iran remains steadfast. Crosstalking the war on Iran and much, much more, we're joined by Alistair Crook in Rome. He is a former British diplomat and one of the most insightful commentators on geopolitics today. Alistair, welcome to the program. I have so many questions and so little time, so I'm going to start out right now. Are we witnessing the unraveling of American empire in the Middle East, possibly further afield?
It has the potential for that. But we haven't arrived at that point yet, I think. We're getting on that road. There is no doubt that this war has huge geopolitical implications, depending on how it turns out. But at the moment, we haven't quite got there yet, but various elements of it are in place. And the financial crisis will be a particular important, if you like, inflection point in this.
Well, you know, Donald Trump has already declared victory in this. Let me read to you what he said. He says he started the Iran war to keep us out of a war with Iran. I don't want to waste too much time on dealing with that kind of psychobabble. But you say that there are grave implications for a shift in the geopolitical order. If Donald Trump wanted to take an off-ramp, is there such a thing as an off-ramp now? And does Israel have a veto?
Well, both Israel has a veto and Iran has a veto. Mm. They need that because, I mean, what we're dealing with is two completely different forms of war. One is the typical Western aerial bombardment, massive aerial bombardment, by standoff aircraft firing cruise missiles into Iran. And of course, that is doing damage. Is it having an effect? What effect is it going to have in terms of the strategy? We just don't know at this point. But what is also clear is that Iran is pursuing a long planned asymmetrical war against the United States. And really, as they say, and it's clear that that's correct, you know, it's only just getting started. They haven't used many things. They haven't used many of the 10 to 12 different types of cruise missiles. Some of them are hypersonic. Some have got multiple submunitions, warheads. Some of them are steerable. They haven't seen, despite it all, I think we've only just seen their strategic speedboats, and their, if you like, submersible drones being used in Hormuz. So, you know, it's just getting started. So, you know, we have to wait and see what the full potential looks like, which we haven't got to yet. But when we see the full potential, then we'll be able to judge better whether, you know, what actually is the balance sheet, if you like, of this portion.
You know, and you know, no one knows how this is going to end, and anyone that says they do know is a fool, considering what we've seen in this century alone with the United States and its interventions in the Middle East. But one thing is clear to me is that, number one, Iran will not accept going back to the status quo. That is for sure. And I would also, considering what you just said about what they still have in their arsenal, it will be Iran that will be dictating the terms and conditions of a ceasefire and an end to this conflict. Would you agree or disagree with that?
Well, I agree entirely. I mean, the terms will be onerous for the United States, maybe politically impossible, but it would be an end to the endless threats of war. And to the siege on the economy. And it would also require and also include an end to the siege on the Palestinians in Gaza and on Palestinian land. So, I mean, this may not be possible. And as you say, Netanyahu or the Israelis do have a say in this. I mean, it was they who, if you like, compelled Trump to the war at that Mar-a-Lago meeting summit at the end of the year on 29th of December. And they said to him very much, you have to, you, it's not the nuclear issue. Now, it's not so much that, it is the missiles. You've got to destroy all of the missiles because they are not just restoring them, they are producing a completely different paradigm of missile defense. And he gave them a green light.
You know, in this war, I think we all can assume that Israel wanted the United States to attack Iran to do much of the heavy lifting, because Israel, it doesn't get as much reporting, but Israel is trying to affect a failed state status for Lebanon simultaneously. It's no, we shouldn't be surprised that this is all happening at the same time.
We should not. As I've been trying to describe, I mean, it's complicated, but Iran, in order to cope with the threats and decapitations, because of what they saw in the Iraq War, the decapitation that took place in Baghdad on the command, if you like, echelon of Saddam Hussein's army, have dispersed command across many autonomous regions, with their commanders having their own missiles and with sealed orders about what to do if a supreme leader is killed. And that's what they opened after the killing of the supreme leader, the bombing of him in his home. And then within an hour, that decentralized system, which is, if you like, a sort of mechanized structure that can continue the war, whatever happens to the command leadership in Tehran, can continue and continue with the delegated authority, which is in their instruction, and no one can countermand it under the constitution except a new supreme leader.
Alistair, which party in this conflict has escalation dominance? Because, you know, we have to take into account desalinization plants, energy facilities. Once one party starts parlaying into that area, the other will. And we're beginning to see that. Water is more precious in the Middle East than oil. So who has escalation dominance?
At this time, it's Iran, because they have escalation dominance over I call it a gated almost, because gated in the sense that it is shut to your adversaries but open to press. But at any point, we could see the Houthis coming in and escalating it further by cutting off the Saudi attempt to ship oil via the Red Sea. The Houthis haven't joined in this war so far, but they're ready to do so. I think they're just waiting for a green light when it is suitable for Iran. But we've seen last night, particularly, we saw Hezbollah coming in with massive attack on northern Israel, to the extent that they were almost calling for evacuation of the north. These are a really major attack, and that has shocked Israeli to the core, because they were told and they've been persuaded, you know, Hezbollah was it had been wounded and had been largely destroyed, and they produced a huge attack. Well, that was one escalation. The other escalation was the ship we saw on fire, an American-linked ship on fire, going to set off the markets. That is what matters to Trump more than anything else. The test for him, markets, 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 because he's worried about the midterm.
Is there anything the United States can do to wrestle control of the Straits of Hormuz? Because I seriously doubt the Iranians are mining it. They really don't have to do that. No. But Trump is putting a marker down that he's going to keep it open. Obviously, it is being gatekeeped. I liked how the way you put it there. But there's nothing the United States can do to change that status quo without Iran.
Exactly. In fact, you know, the Iranians control it by artillery. The range from the artillery to the midpoint of the Straits is about 21 kilometers. Well, within mines are complicated and they, you know, get untethered or float away. No, they don't. So, and they haven't used until, I think, yesterday was perhaps the first day, as far as I understand it. But they had, you know, not only these submersible drones,
right,
and they have speedboats, and they have submarines. They have 25 to 35 mini submarines that can fire anti-ship missiles from below the surface. So, you know, they've got many more, you know, arrows in their quiver than we've seen so far. So they have that. Is it going to be a big surprise coming? Well, we don't know for sure. But I'm slightly dubious of these claims. There's a B-1 aircraft that has been has left Fairport, I think, and is on its way to the Middle East. You know, what is it carrying? I don't know. And the other thing is that the Iranians have tracked it from its takeoff, because they now have really the equivalent of, you know, the IRS system. So important to the Western support of Ukrainians. That is intelligence, reconnaissance, and surveillance from satellites, from AWACS, from aircraft, from intercept. All of that put together to create a sort of virtual map that provided targeting.
I have to jump in. We're going to go to a break here. Just as a footnote for everyone, the United States, I think it was even this month, retired four of its minesweepers. This month. Consider the timing of all of that here. All right, we're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on the war on Iran. Stay with our team. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing the war on Iran. Okay, Alistair, you made slight reference to it in the first part of the program, and I want to go into more depth here. What is the fate of the petrodollar? Is it a fading? Is it discredited? What's the future?
Yes. I mean, what we're seeing is a desperate attempt by Trump to save, the dollar hegemony, because he needs that dollar hegemony in order really to provide, if you like, the revenues and the money that inflow into the United States to keep the bond market from crashing. And so the dollar hegemony gives him the ability. It's a sort of a triple thing, a connection. They need dollar hegemony, and the dollar hegemony depends on military hegemony. And the dollar hegemony is now suffering from dollar uncertainty and the fact that the dollar and the U.S. military hegemony may be about to take a very bad, if you like, symbolic hit at the very least.
You know, Alistair, the Gulf monarchies, I call them kind of brands. They're not full nation states. In many of them, the majority of the people living there are dual passport holders. But one thing they do is they've presented themselves to the world as being a very safe place for other people's money. What is the... there's possible trajectories here. Once this conflict is resolved one way or another, where do these Gulf monarchies go? Do they get in bed with the Americans and Israelis even more? Or do they declare Switzerland neutrality? Because the United States hasn't done a whole lot to protect these people and a lot of other people's money.
Uh, uh, I did hear, I saw that a lot of Asian money was leaving the States precisely for the reason you said. They thought it was a safe place to invest in the whole money. And now the UAE has put a limit on how much you can transfer overseas. So obviously something is, you know, there's a big outflow. And that outflow is not going to stay in dollars. I don't think it's going to go into renminbi or gold or gold tokens that Russia is inaugurating, these sort of types of investment. I think the model is, the brand, as you called it correctly, is broken. And I heard about from one big fund manager who was in Dubai, and he said, listen, it's over in Dubai. I'm leaving and I'm not coming back. So, I mean, that's just one mad person. But I think on the whole, you know, that whole vibe of, you know, sun, beaches, money, shopping and so on, it, you know, people are not coming back for that.
You know,
a few will check back, but no man.
You and your wife do remarkable service for us all because you cover the Hebrew press like no other people that I know of here. What is the Israeli press telling its own people about the condition of their own country and the status of this conflict?
Well, almost nothing.
Okay.
I mean, the lockdown is so severe. It's really, really tough. So the only things that are being really discussed in the Hebrew press is the crisis. You know, they don't say that it's because we're being defeated, but they say the crisis is affecting Netanyahu and the elections now are looking very uncertain. And there's a big crisis about the Haredi, who are going to get a massive amount of more money given to them to keep them in the coalition. Really, that is a major crisis shaping up, a major conflict internally within Israel. And I'm not sure that Netanyahu is going to survive it. I mean that both in the political sense and in the physical.
Alistair, do you have any idea where Netanyahu is? He's, you know, ever since the start of this conflict here, outside of a few bombastic comments, we haven't seen very much of him. Is he in Israel?
No one knows.
No one knows.
Total silence. I think it's 4 days since there's been a direct, if you like, evidence.
And one more question about Israel. I mean, you know, Twitter X is not the best source of information. As a matter of fact, it's a source of disinformation often. But I see all of these pictures from Tel Aviv Airport, Ben Gurion Airport, of people leaving. Do you have any idea what the outflow is?
No. The countdown on all information. You know, the Israelis have now put a 5-year jail sentence for taking any photographs of incoming missiles or of the effects afterwards. 5-year imprisonment directly. So, I mean, you know, you occasionally get a video that's coming out that you know is real and is, you know, the proper thing. But, I mean, everything is completely shut down. So, no, we don't have a full idea. There is huge damage being done to Israel. But actually, the extent of it and the nature of it, you can't sort of quantify it in a sort of a balance of war, a sort of effort. You've got to try and guess it.
Alistair, you know, in your many of your conflicts forum newsletters, you talk about the kind of messianic thinking that's going on when it comes to the United States. Can you elaborate on that? You know, because we have Pete Hegseth, and it's been reports that senior military officers are kind of preaching the gospel of Armageddon, the return of Christ. I mean, this should terrify all of us if that is motivating how they see this conflict. It's really interesting to me is that I was in high school when the revolution occurred in Iran, and ever since then I've been told it's a country full of religious fanatics. But the religious fanaticism I see comes out of the West, not Iran.
And within Israel, because
in Israel,
it was predicted In the 1920s, they called the term messianic. And this is what has happened. We are moving into an eschatological period in Israel, with the right, particularly the sort of secular national religious part of them, looking to Armageddon as something they accept and want. I remember watching a video of Smotrich some years ago, in which he was outlined how they hope to remove Palestinians from Gaza and other areas. And he said, but what we really need, what we want, is a major crisis or a big war, and then we'll complete our plans. So I keep saying to the West, you know, when you start trying to look at Israel through a secular rationalist lens, you won't understand it, because you'll say, well, it makes no sense for them to want war. But they do. And now, as you correctly point out, we're getting some of the, you know, the Armageddon language coming out of parts of America, mostly from the evangelical, but from other elements of it, saying that this is, you know, God's will, this is something that must be done. So we have, you know, there is, and of course, one feeds off the other. It's becoming a sort of religious war in some respects. You don't see this so much. You see something quite different in Iran. It's not that sort of, if you like, eschatology. It is the eschatology of waiting for the Mahdi, which is a different thing from trying to force redemption. Yeah, by starting them all.
Yeah, I've never if it's inevitable, then why do we have to push it? It's going to happen anyway. I've never got my head around that. Let's go further afield geopolitically. How are the Russians and the Chinese viewing all of this?
Well, the Chinese are always cautious and say that they would like things to be sorted. And Russia is a puzzle, and I'm not quite sure. You're probably the person to help me understand it. So Russia has been saying that there needs to be a negotiated settlement. But I mean, they don't say, what does that mean? I mean, how do you arrive at that? Maybe they keep that for the sort of the negotiations or to whisper in the ear. I gather that Kirill Dmitriev has been in Florida whispering to Witkoff and Kushner. Just in his last day. I don't know what he's whispering to them or what it's about. I'm a little bemused about that. Is it about Ukraine? Is it about Iran? And what sort of position is Russia going to take? I mean, because, of course, it must see very clearly that what Iran has been doing is ultimately very consequential for Russia and important, not only just as an example, but is important because, you know, what they are doing is really taking control over the choke points and the seaway of the Gulf, which will make it impossible for the United States to continue this attempt to squeeze the corridors of energy, so that China doesn't get its energy and Russia cannot export its energy. Yeah. And that's very, very important to Russia and to China.
You know, I think we're in agreement. It's quite astounding. Donald Trump, it seems to be playing roulette, and he's not getting winning numbers here. How can anyone in the world trust the United States again, even including its allies, particularly in the Gulf? Last minute, go ahead.
Well, we've seen. I mean, you know, this has been twice that Witkoff has been party to an absolute deception. How does one treat it?
All right, Alistair, I want to thank you for being with us here on Crosstalk. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk rules.